Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's Thanksgiving Day, November the 24th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my boys, for freedom is the rising.
The first thing I want to do this week is to extend my thanks to all of the comrades who attended our get-together in Salem, Oregon this past Saturday. Some of you I'd met before and some not, but it was good for me to see all of you, and an especially appreciative note of gratitude is due to our hosts for the meeting and the excellent spread they put on for the comrades. Secondly, I would like to apologize to our listeners for some idiotic anti-Nazi and anti-Hitler comments that appeared in last week's Larkin Rose segment. Like I said at the time, I pulled that clip off YouTube, and I had originally edited that nonsense out, but the quality was so bad that our sound wizard, who does the final edit on this show, had to go to the original YouTube and pull himself a copy and do his own edit, and he inadvertently let the hate Hitler horseshit through. I went back, and I edited the crap out, and I re-uploaded a Linian Troy version, so that's gone now. The new fourth edition of the Northwest Front's Party Manual, the Northwest Migration Handbook, which is also known as the White Book, is now out. It's available from lulu.com for the princely sum of $10. I've posted the link for that site on the Thought Crime blog and elsewhere, but for those of you who missed it, email me at nwnet@earthlink.net and I'll send it to you. On another topic, guys, when you want to contact me, it's always best to use that direct email address I just gave you and not send me a message on Facebook, since I don't check Facebook but every couple of days, and as a communications medium, it sucks. Plus, you can be sure that nowhere else on the internet is as likely to be monitored by the enemy as Facebook. Although the cops and the FBI don't seem to be able to do much about criminal nigger flash mobs being organized on Facebook and MySpace and whatnot, or maybe they're just not interested. That's another curious thing. The FBI spent how much money and time and effort to entrap and imprison Edgar Steele using fabricated audio tapes, and yet where are they with this Occupy Wall Street crowd? It strikes me, after almost 2 months now, that I have yet to see one single reference anywhere in any news media story to the FBI taking any interest in what is clearly a left-wing conspiracy to break the law, destroy private property, and violate people's civil rights. Have any of you? Okay, this is Thanksgiving week, and I understand that most of you guys out there are probably going to be too busy with holiday-related stuff to bother much with listening to Radio Free Northwest this week. So I suppose this would be a good episode for me to tack on a bunch of odds and ends that I've had hanging around on my hard drive for a while. Now, first off, here's an audio file that I've had for about a month now, and I haven't had an opportunity to get it on the air until now. This is from a comrade who, for various reasons, it wouldn't be politic for me to name. So let's just piss off all the liberals who are listening and call him Edward R. Murrow.
I want to take my turn at addressing the character issue, as Harold calls it, and let me say up front that I too have character problems. Unlike many people, I freely admit to them, and I'm working on straightening out my thinking. My talk today is on the topic of courage. In one of my favorite movies of all times, The Wizard of Oz, we meet a cowardly lion who finds his courage and takes his rightful place as king of the forest. My friends, there are only two things in life that are inevitable, death and taxes. You've already been taxed to your knees, but have you ever pondered your death? Rest assured it's coming, whether it's tomorrow or 50 years out. None of us know that magical date, and unless we're planning a coward's death by suicide, we can't much control the timing. But we do have some say over our death, the how. The question that you must ask yourself is, how do I want to die? Do you want to die in a state-owned, Obama-mandated nursing home at the age of 87 with a shitty diaper on your ass and an IV in your arm while being tended to by an Indian nursing assistant whose last name invariably will be Patel? Trust me, there's no dignity in dying that way. Or do you want to die with dignity as a soldier fighting for the most important cause under the sun, namely procuring a happy and prosperous future for your children and all white children? Ideally, when the anti-colonial war for independence comes, we'd prefer that the enemy do the dying and we do the surviving. But in any war, many soldiers give their lives for their cause, and this one will be no different. For those of you who are functional atheists and believe this life you are now experiencing is your only existence, know that your descendants and all white children, for that matter, will live free because of your courage and sacrifice, never experiencing the bondage of Zionist slavery and the Jews' anti-white genocide machine, better known as the U.S. government. For those of you who are theists of one flavor or another, this will be your opportunity to prove to your respective deity that you're not just a sorry sack of bleach white shit to be consigned to Aryan hell. This will be your chance to earn your eternal reward in Valhalla or White Heaven. And for those of us who believe we have another life to live following this one, I'm hinting at reincarnation, doing your duty this time around might give you the chance to come back to experiencing this white Eden we're working for as a baby born free in the Northwest American Republic. Heaven knows we'll all deserve it considering these dark days and toil ahead. The purpose of me bringing up religion is to show whatever views you might hold, for the white race, extinction is not an option. In case you never realized it, your race is just an extension of your family. If my own children were threatened, I would do everything I could to save them, including offering my own life in exchange for saving theirs. When the War of Independence comes, I'll willingly offer my own life so that all the white children of the world might have a chance to live free. Many of us are going to have to die prematurely so that generations of white children yet unborn will live. In my case, I'd rather die at 62 from head-on-head combat with Zog's minions rather than die of natural causes in a Zog nursing home at age 87. I'm going to be honest and admit that in my 43 years, I've never done anything courageous. I've done things that are average, like doing well in school, picking up a college degree or two, getting married, fathering two children, and so forth. But now in middle age, I'm beginning to feel a bit empty inside. Frankly, I've never taken on any exceptional challenge, whether fighting in a war, running 26 miles in a marathon, climbing Mont Blanc, or dog sledding to the South Pole. Taking up arms will be an honor for me. I will see myself as the modern-day incarnation of the 300 valiant Spartans, the Roman legions, the Crusaders, the Teutonic Knights, and the Waffen SS. Seen from a psychological viewpoint, taking part in a guerrilla war against Zog will be highly therapeutic for me. Talk about a boost to my self-esteem. It will be a chance for me to really feel like a man, a warrior. All of us men, and some of the ladies, know that there is a warrior inside of us, a sleeper, who, if we allow, will awaken. After living this average, ordinary American life, I will finally have the chance to take part in something extraordinary. I wish to stress that we, and that means you the listener, are facing the most important struggle ever to unfold under the sun. Let me rephrase that. We are involved in the most important cause in the history of the world. Our actions today and in the near future will determine whether our race survives and finds its destiny in the stars, or whether it goes extinct. Boy, did the gods of fate dish us out a plate. Being born in turbulent times is both a blessing and a curse. Each of us stands at a crossroads. We can accept our duty and give our race a fighting chance, or we can shirk our duty and watch Dancing with the Stars, Jersey Shores, and reruns of The Addams Family while drowning our sorrows in beer, all the time watching our neighborhood become a stinking third-world dump. That is, until we're committed to a government-approved deathing center with an ugly, shit-skinned immigrant hag named Kalpana Patel playing the role of a modern-day Nurse Ratched and dominatrix. My friends, I submit there is no honor in passively watching this country turn into the third world from the comfort of your lazy boy. If you can't raise a finger for your children and other white children, you're more than just a coward. You're not even a man. Let me tell you, it takes more than having testicles to be a man. A man instinctually protects his women and children. That's the way of courage. What is the alternative? The path of cowardice. It's easy to fall to the dark side by imbibing the collective cackling of our parents and non-racist siblings, all brain numb from 40 years of Jewish TV programming, thereby allowing a white future to be snuffed out. Or we can follow our consciences and the cookbook-style directions for guerrilla warfare in old Harold's novels while there's still an out window for opportunity. A famous British statesman of years gone by made an observation that seems tailor-made for us. Quote, "If you will not fight for right when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight when your victory is sure and not too costly, you may come to the moment when you will have to fight with all the odds against you and only a precarious chance of survival. There may even be a worse case. You may have to fight when there is no hope of victory, because it is better to perish than to live as slaves." In closing, let me say there is no reason to fear death. You're going to die of something, whether it's cancer, a stroke, or an FBI bullet. My dream is to fight for the day when we win our freedom from Zog. And if I don't live to see the day when I get a gold medal plastered on my chest for courage, I'll settle for one of Zog's lead slugs, because even dying in the arms of my comrades, I'll know that I died a real man and a hero for that. Here's to finding your courage. Thank you for your attention.
And here's a quick word or two from Gretchen the Librarian on the subject of bad karma and how to avoid it.
Good evening, comrades. Dan would like to talk to you about how we can eliminate our concern about karmic debt. Now, I know this is something that Harold talks a lot about in his books, and he says that people might end up engaging in activity that would cause karmic debt. This concern about karmic debt is something that is addressed in the Bhagavad Gita, and Lord Krishna tells us how we can avoid karmic debt. So I'd like to share that with you. Okay, in this particular passage, he says, "One who has abandoned selfish attachment to the fruits of work and remains ever content and dependent on no one but God, such a person, though engaged in activity, does nothing at all and incurs no karmic reaction." So if you make your work, whatever that is, a sacrifice to God and do not want material gain for yourself, then your work is essentially made clean or made innocent in a sense by the fact that you do not wish for gains for yourself, but only do what is right and make your work a sacrifice. Lately, I've been studying the Dharma Shastras, and again, it was reiterated that those who abandon the fruits of action and devote their work to God, they do not incur karmic debt, and in fact, they incur divine protection. So that verse really reverberated with me, and I became very excited, and I wanted to share scripture with you, so that you could know how to alleviate possible karmic debt. I also want to remind you that it is important to donate money and make other sacrifices for the Northwest Front. Isha Upanishad tells us that we should rejoice in renunciation and covet nothing, for all belongs to the Lord. I've found that in my own giving, that I've always had enough to give to Harold, and sometimes I don't even know where the money comes from. Sometimes I think the money magically reproduces itself in my money drawer, because sometimes I don't think that I have enough, and then I'll go and I'll always find enough money. Or someone will give me money, or I'll find some little job to make enough money. So by God's grace, and because I've been sacrificing, I've always had enough. I think everyone should sacrifice to Harold, and then they will get more, because the universe gives you more when you sacrifice. It's just what Ian Stewart says about become sacrifice. When you give, you will receive. And as counterintuitive as that seems, that's what I've found so far in my life. So thank you for listening to this, and I hope that you develop a love of the Dharma Shastra text, so that you can understand how to avoid karmic debt, how to lessen debt, and eventually how to be liberated in both this world and the next, and liberated from rebirth. So thank you very much for listening this week.
I was a little hesitant about airing that one at first because it sounds like I'm letting Gretchen do my fund appeals for me, but I thought about it and I figured, what the hell? The fact is that as soon as the holidays and the new year is over, I'm going to be trying to drag the NF a few more agonizing inches forward in several ways, which I described to those of you who receive our printed material and read the fall status report. And we're going to need money for that, so maybe Gretchen can succeed in loosening a few purse strings that I can't. Okay, I am sorry to waste airtime and your time once again with movement silliness, but it seems that once again we're hearing from that 90s show, claiming that due to a casual comment that Axis Sally made a couple of months ago about stomping on cats that run into your house, the Northwest Front in some way advocates or practices the abuse of animals. I'm not kidding. I wish I was making this up, but unfortunately not. It's still floating around on the internet. So, let me spell this out loud and clear. The Northwest Front does not in any way advocate, condone, or practice the abuse of animals in any way.
Spring is here, a suffering is here. Life is Skittles and life is beer. I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring. I do, don't you? Of course you do. But there's one thing that makes spring complete for me and makes every Sunday a treat for me. All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park. When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide, but they still go for peanuts when coated with the cyanide. The sun's shining bright, everything seems all right when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We've gained notoriety and caused much anxiety in the Audubon Society with our games. They call it impiety and lack of propriety and quite a variety of unpleasant names. But it's not against any religion to want to dispose of a pigeon. So if Sunday you're free, why don't you come with me and we'll poison the pigeons in the park. And maybe we'll do in a squirrel or two while we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We'll murder them all amid laughter and merriment, except for the few we take home to experiment. My pulse will be quickening with each drop of strychnine we feed to a pigeon. It just takes a smidgen to poison a pigeon in the park.
Yeah, I know, that was silly, but I swear, sometimes when I hear from these idiots, I just can't resist the urge to play with them. Okay, this is, I guess, what we have come to call the talk show part of Radio Free Northwest. We're going to kick it off this week with the vitally important topic of nigger butt cheeks.
I've been told this isn't as bad as it sounds.
Well, it may not be as bad as it sounds. I wanted to inquire at a technical college in the area, and when I was there, I was wandering through the place. It was the first time I'd been there. I was walking through the hallways, and these two niggers walk out of a classroom. And no, this isn't a joke. This is actually a real story. They're walking out. There's one big lumbering guy. There is a other friend with them. And they're just talking about their butt cheeks the whole time and how they're going to learn to flex them. I'm walking out. This big nigger with his pants pulled down, just sauntering through the hallway, talking about, yeah, I'm going to learn how to flex my butt cheeks. Go flex them butt cheeks. I swear, as I'm walking along, and I was laughing a little bit because I was laughing at them, not with them, of course. This is all they were talking about, just going back and forth. I must have heard the phrase, my butt cheeks, about 15 times. Look, as I walked down the hallway, so I was walking along just, yeah, I'm going to learn how to flex my butt cheeks, in case his little friend didn't hear him the first three times he said it. It's like, yeah, man, yeah, my butt cheeks. Gonna flex, yeah, gonna flex my butt cheeks. Is this really what we're heading for, people? I mean, come on.
Well, we're already there. This is a Negroid fashion. You know, Bill Cosby and the mayor of Philadelphia and some of these other big, more sedate nigger types have already gotten on these young black males saying, pull your pants up, nigga! So I suppose we can use this to segue into telling our favorite true nigger story. And everyone in the movement has one. This actually might not be a good idea. This might not be a bad idea for Radio Free Northwest. If we just, okay, everybody just do an audio file, do an MP3, your favorite true nigger story. Okay, I'll kick off. All right, back when I got back from Ireland in the late 1980s, I had to do a number of menial clerical jobs for various temp agencies, etc. I ended up at an insurance company in Raleigh, North Carolina, literally shuffling insurance forms all day. And by the way, you young white people out there, don't ever choose insurance as a career. Insurance rots the mind, I can tell you that. I mean, have you ever actually tried to sit down and think about insurance? Anyway, so it's me, and at that point, I was like the only male employee in this little sort of office bay thing with a bunch of cubicles, and we all had our forms that we were shuffling and assembling the policies, and some white girls were there, and a bunch of nigger women, of course, young nigger females. And so this would have been in January of 88, I guess, and it was coming up on the Martin Luther King holiday. And the negresses were sitting there mumbling and muttering back and forth about Martin Luther King. And I remember one of these negresses' name was Keisha Spees. That is a genuine nigger name. Anyway, this one negress, Keisha, asked this other kind of high-yelling negress, I was watching TV that day. They're talking about when they killed Martin Luther King. Did they ever catch that man what killed Martin Luther King? What was his name? Booth. John Wilkes Booth. I'm not making this up. And so Gloria replied, no, Keisha, I don't think it was Booth. I don't think it was John Wilkes Booth. I think it was James Earl Ray who shot Martin Luther King. See, at first they thought it was Booth, but then they figured out it was James Earl Ray. I had this vision of the Memphis police in 67 putting out an all-points bulletin for John Wilkes Booth. And I was sitting there laughing over in my cubicle. One of the negresses said, Harold, what are you laughing at? I said, John Wilkes Booth shot Martin Luther King, did he? Was that before or after Lee Harvey Oswald shot Garfield? Garfield, of course, being a president who was assassinated, but they didn't know that. And one of them said, Garfield? Who Garfield? He that cat in the comic book. Somebody shoot that cat. And the supervisor comes in, and by this time, I'm hysterical. I am rolling on the floor. And she looks at Harold, what's the matter with you? And I just was sort of gesticulating. I couldn't even speak. I was laughing so hard. And Gloria said, somebody done shot that cat in the comics, and Harold thinks it's funny as hell. I mean, I swear on a stack of mine comps, I am not making this up. This happened. Okay, now one of you guys gets to go.
Okay, well, I've noticed that niggers can actually be really funny sometimes when they're not out looting and raping and, you know, burning stuff. Just when they're being themselves, just out in the world, if you like to go nigger watching, you can see a lot of hilarious things. The funniest thing, I think, is when you see several black stereotypes going on all at once. Like them walking around in their baggy pants, their pants are falling down, their hands are practically dragging on the ground, and they're kind of bebopping along to music only they can hear, just breaking into this spontaneous Negro dancing. I hear that's... It's a real thing. Especially if they're standing in line at a KFC or something, that's just even funnier.
You got the moves on, man.
I recommend, if you live in a major city and you don't have anything to do, just go to the mall or ride public transportation. Bring your video camera and just make some YouTube clips of just the niggers that you see. But one time at work, I remember a bunch of us were sitting in the break room and we were all talking about things we got in trouble for when we were kids. And I worked with this big, giant, dumb nigger. And he was actually fairly nice. He also embodied every black stereotype there was, except for the violent ones. He dressed in these really obnoxiously loud, patterned, colored suits with the wild tails and the top hats, and just completely inappropriate for the workplace. He was slow and dumb, but just kind of jolly all the time. And he seriously said, well, they used to catch me sneaking into the watermelon patch, and they done shot at me with the rock salt. And I just, there was no holding back. I was falling off my chair, laughing, spewing milk out my nose and everything. And everyone, all my other coworkers, knew why I was laughing, and they disapproved. But they had to admit, that was just so black.
You know, maybe we need to clean up these sessions. We seem to be drifting into these. But then again, when you talk about niggers, how are you going to do it? Like, we had a bunch of nigger colleges in Raleigh, St. Augustine's, Shaw University, was one of those whose name escapes me. Anyway, of course, needless to say, there were big basketball rivals. And I did not see this because it is not my habit, never has been, to attend nigger basketball games. Anyway, I had this described to me the next day after it happened. We had this one negress named Valerie who was working in the same department, big bubble lip, ubangy woman. And she was really enthusiastic for one of the teams, Shaw or St. Augustine's. They were, of course, big rivals. And so they were having the game that night at whatever gym it was, and niggers going back up and forth, bouncing them hoops and making their shots and swinging from the basket like monkeys and all this sort of stuff. And everyone was getting really enthusiastic and jumping up and down, yay, yay. And this one player that Valerie either liked, or it was her boyfriend or ex-boyfriend or something, but she knew him. And she was, of course, right down in the front, and Valerie was jumping up and down like a cheerleader. And at some point in the game, when he just scored a hoop or something like that, she jumps up, she rips off her sweater and her blouse, and so she's got her bare black mammaries hanging out, and she's shaking them up there in his foot. She said, "What's stick of these, my man? What's stick of these?" And he yelled back something, "Yeah, mama, I like that, man. Come on, watch me, mama. I got more moves than X-Lax." And so... But this kind of behavior is totally normal for them. You know, among their more violent and dangerous behavior, they have no inhibitions at all.
You know, that reminds me of something else. I was at a Walmart, and there was this nigger woman browsing through a rack of shorts or something. She's talking on her cell phone, and she's trying on these shorts in the middle of the store and just ripping them off. And you know, she was quite large, and the shorts didn't fit her. She couldn't even pull them all the way up. And she'd just take them off and then throw them on the floor and put on another pair, take those off, right in the middle of the store. And she's got her own shorts on under these, but as she's pulling the Walmart shorts off, you know, her own come down a little. And she just doesn't even care. She's just standing there flashing everyone in the store, talking on her phone. That's normal for these people.
Another interesting aspect of them in Vietnam, and I'm sure Iraq and Afghanistan veterans can confirm this, they're no damn good in the military in a combat situation. It's not so much even cowardice, it's just they're careless, they're stupid, they don't pay attention, they don't follow orders, and this is supposed to be funny, so I'm starting to rant and rave again, but anyway, you get the idea. Another thing now, in today's Radio Free Northwest, we're making this on November 17th, but in today's broadcast of Radio Free Northwest, a gentleman named Chuck wanted us to explain the Jewish question. Now, this is actually, I kind of blew him off because I was in a crotchety Grandpa Simpson mood, but and I explained that I'd actually gone over this several times before. And it's not only that, but the Jewish question is very complex. I mean, there are men like Francis Parker Yockey, William Gailey Simpson, Arnold Leese, A.K. Chesterton, who have spent their whole lives and careers talking about and examining and analyzing the Jewish question. So it's kind of hard to summarize in a few words, but basically, you can't discuss what's wrong in history without discussing Jews any more than you can discuss sickness without talking about germs, microorganisms. The Jews, if I had to sum it up, they are kind of a disease bacillus inside the body of humanity. Everything they do in the long run is destructive to the host organism, the host society in which they live. They have created nothing, even their language, Yiddish, they stole from Germans. There's another Jewish language called Ladino, which the Sephardic Jews of Spain stole from Spanish, and so forth and so on. So I've been trying to think of some quick way to sum up the whole Jewish question, and maybe we can use this particular format to, like we were telling nigger jokes just now, maybe talk about our own individual opinions, observations of the Jews. Any Jewish...
Well, you know, unfortunately, Jews in public, they aren't funny or anything. If I actually went out to go videotape some in their natural habitats, I think I would just get really sick and really pissed off. They're not really anything I want to take home and show people. Oh, look what I saw these kikes out doing. My personal experiences with Jews, I grew up in a really nice white neighborhood, which usually means a lot of Jews live there. And the Jewish families I knew, they were what I would consider, again, very nice people, but I always noticed they stuck together. They did a lot of things only with each other. They excluded the others in the neighborhood.
They don't assimilate. I once worked for Jews for about 3 weeks as a bookkeeper. It was a fairly well-known clothing store in Charleston, South Carolina. And I noticed a couple of things. All of the invoices where this individual, the store owner, got all of his supplies, his clothing, his accessories of various kinds, everyone that he did business with was another Jew. And sometimes he would go as far away as New York or New Jersey and Florida just to do business for some fairly minor $20 order, whatever. But he would always give it to another Jew. And I left that particular position when, this is after about 3 weeks now, he asked me to do something in my capacity as bookkeeper, which was frankly illegal. And I pointed this out to him, and he just, well, my old bookkeeper used to do it all the time. And I said, well, then your old bookkeeper was breaking the law. Basically, it involved giving him cash money out of specific accounts, which, okay, technically speaking, he might have been able to do that as the business owner. But the situation would have been that large amounts of cash would have been withdrawn from the account, and my signature would have been on the withdrawal slip in the document. In other words, he not only wanted cash out of his business, he wanted it untraceable back to him. And anyway, without going off into a long digression here, I left because within 3 weeks, this kike was asking me to steal for him.
Well, I think that's one of the central issues of the Jewish question is inherently they want to take from others. That's kind of what they've been about for so long. In the Northwest introductory packets, you get a little slip called Why Are the Jews Persecuted? And that's a very interesting question. You hear all of this business about the Holocaust, all of this persecution, all of these bad things that were done to them, all these people that don't like them, and the question of why that is never really asked. And when it is, it's written off to bigotry or just hatred or, oh, well, they just had a different religion or they had different lifestyles. Well, okay, but when you really look at the big picture, that explanation really misses quite a lot. Because for one thing, whenever one of these outbursts of anti-Semitism occurs, either in the Third Reich or Ferdinand or in Isabella or anything previously to that, they've always done something to other people that have drawn them to do these kinds of things to them. I think the Jewish question ties straight in with Zionism and with the nature of the Jewish people themselves, and they are a separate, distinct people, either by blood or by deed. All of them are defined by a common mindset, which means that their entire worldview revolves around them getting specifically what they want at the expense of everyone else. This is the heart of Zionism. This is why Israel is such a big issue. I mean, think about it, people. Honestly, all of you whites out there listening to Radio Free Northwest, if we did it right now, if we formed the homeland in the Northwest, wouldn't you all come here? If you knew there was a place for just white people and only white people, wouldn't you all be in here right now? There's a place only for Jews in Israel, and yet they're not all there all at once. Many of them still remain in the United States. Why is that? It's because they want what we have, up to and including our identity. They're the only other people closest to being an Aryan, but they're not, and they despise it. It makes them very angry, very bitter people. And they haven't stopped yet. They will milk persecution amongst themselves as much as they can, yet they have no problem doing it on others. They inflict it on the Palestinians, they've inflicted it on fellow Aryans throughout history, and that can be a whole, there have been entire books written about it, one of them titled Jewish Ritual Murder, Secrets of the Talmud, anything like that. But that's where it comes from. They want what other people have, and they'll do anything to get it.
The Yiddish name for America is the Golden Medina, which means the golden honeycomb. I think one of the best ways to introduce people to the Jewish question is to get them into Holocaust revisionism. That right there is the great revelation that I think will strike the scales from anybody's eyes. Once you realize that the whole so-called Holocaust is a fraud, that it never happened in any way, shape, or form remotely resembling the official story, and that basically these people have been defrauding the world and literally milking this lie for billions of dollars for almost 70 years now. Once you realize that you are dealing with a race of people, a nation of people who are capable of doing something like that, then you know what you need to know about the Jews.
I do need to come up with a simple, maybe one paragraph line that I can give to people when they ask, you know, why do you hate Jews? Because when it's asked suddenly of me like that, all I can come up with is, oh, well, they lie about the Holocaust and, you know, the Palestinians and, they just whine about being persecuted all the time.
Well, someone once asked Commander Rockwell, I don't know if it was quite in those terms, it was like, what's wrong with the Jews or something like that. And Commander Rockwell says, well, have you ever heard of the psychiatric term paranoid schizophrenia? And the guy says, yes. And Rockwell said, well, the Jews have made an entire religion out of it, which actually is not a bad way to describe them. Another little saying I've heard is the word anti-Semite has two definitions. The first definition is someone who hates the Jews. And the second one is someone who is hated by the Jews. It's a very hard thing to encapsulate in a few words, but I would say if someone asks you flat out, why do you hate the Jews? You should just look at them and say, because the Jews hate me, because they hate our people, and because they are trying to kill us. I tell you what really turned me, or what really brought all this home to me. I was a sort of self-converted National Socialist, but when I got to Arlington with the old party, the NSWPP, and I started doing night duty there behind the duty desk, and this was in the days before email and that sort of stuff, all we had was a phone, good old rotary phone, and it would ring, 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 and the phone generally would start ringing about 8 o'clock at night if you're doing a night shift, and it would ring and ring and ring all night some nights, and it was nothing on there except Jew hecklers who were calling us, mostly from New York, sometimes from Silver Spring, Maryland, and places where they lived. But you'd pick up the phone, and you would hear this screaming voice with nothing but obscenities. And sometimes, as a kind of an experiment, I would just hold the phone. I wouldn't say anything. And I'd usually get bored after about 5 minutes, but the Jew on the other end wouldn't. This kike would literally be screaming filthy words for a solid 5 minutes, after which I'd usually have enough of it and hang up. But there is an evil in these people, a hatred of life that is very, very hard to describe unless you have actually seen it up front.
And what's with their obsession with feces?
Yeah, Sarah Silverman. Have you ever seen Sarah Silverman?
Oh, unfortunately, I have.
Well, this woman, by the way, is a highly respected comedian. She gets rave reviews in Israel in the media. I know because I read Israeli newspapers on the web. The Israelis adore her. She is the darling of Hollywood society, and her whole shtick, as the Jews call it, consists of mostly feces and jokes about her Jewish heritage. And there's this one, again, I keep telling myself we need to clean this up, but there's this one, well, of course, talking about Sarah Silverman, that's hard to do, but there's this one scene in one of her shows where she, shall we say, sexually molests her dog. This is on camera. It's part of a routine. I don't think anybody but a Jew could get away with some of that crap, even in today's Hollywood, but this is what the Jews consider funny.
It's an easy subject to be able to go off on because there really is so much you can talk about. It really encompasses a lot of things, and like you said, and unless you've actually experienced it, and I'm sure my experiences aren't quite as extensive as yours are, but I have had some, and I will say each time, even before I was really heavily racially aware, I always was to some degree or another, but before I was very big into it, I would notice it and make the connection, and I think a lot of people who don't live in it have difficulty doing it. But the long story short, the Jewish question is directly connected to Zionism and them trying to take what others have to advance themselves at the expense of others while criticizing others of doing the exact same thing, I guess is maybe.
Well, they're parasites. They cannot live without a host. Everyone I've never known who's been to Israel tells me that these people are crazy. They don't talk to each other on the street. They scream at each other. They drive like maniacs. Their highway fatality toll is the worst in the world. They're literally a nation of lunatics because they're forced to live with each other. And one of the reasons that they're so mean to the Palestinians is that they have to have someone to leech off of. Anyway, enough about Jews. Well, today is Thanksgiving Day, so I guess I'll dedicate this next music break to all of you guys out there, and unfortunately a few ladies as well, nowadays, who are sitting at home, all alone, eating Spam for your Thanksgiving dinner, because your deranged ex-spouse and her satanic attorney cleaned you out in some stupid, pointless, and viciously cruel divorce settlement. How's that for a cheery holiday sentiment? This is Jerry Reed.
Well, I guess it was back in 63 when eating my cooking got the better of me, so I asked this little girl I was going with to be my wife. Well, she said she would, so I said I do. But I'd have said I wouldn't if I'd have just knew how saying I do was gonna screw up all of my life. Well, the first few years weren't all that bad. I'll never forget the good times we had, cause I'm reminded every month when I send her the child support. Well, it wasn't too long till the lust all died, and I'll admit I wasn't too surprised the day I come home and found my suitcase sitting out on the porch. Well, I tried to get in, she changed the lock. Then I found this note taped on the mailbox that said, "Goodbye, Turkey, my attorney will be in touch." So I decided right then and there, I was gonna do what's right, give her fair share. But brother, I didn't know her share was gonna be that much. She got the gold mine, I got the share. They split it right down the middle, and then they give her the better half. Well, it all sounds sort of funny, but it hurts too much to laugh. She got the gold mine, I got the share. Now listen, you ain't heard nothing yet. Why, they give her the color television set, then they give her the house, the kids, and both of the cars. See? Well, then they start talking about child support, alimony, and the cost of the court. Didn't take me long to figure out how far in the toilet I was. I'm telling you, they have made a mistake, cause it adds up to more than this cowboy makes. Besides, everything I ever had worth taking, they've already took. While she's living like a queen on alimony, I'm working two shifts, eating bologna, asking myself, why didn't you just learn how to cook? They give her the gold mine, they give me the share. They said they're splitting it all down the middle, but she got the better half. Well, it all sounds mighty funny, but it hurts too much to laugh. She got the gold mine, I got the share. It all down the middle, and then to give her the better half. Well, I guess it all sounds funny, but it hurts too much to laugh. She got the gold mine, I got the share. Yeah. Hey, kid, I got the share. But I don't have to worry about toting a billfold anymore. I let my wife tote it. I'm gonna be carrying food stamps. You get it, Judge? I'm gonna be just. That's not funny, huh?
Greetings, comrades. This is Axis Sally, and do you know what I'm doing right now? I'm at the Northwest Publishing Agency getting a head start on a lot of Thanksgiving baking. Those who know me and who will not be at our Thanksgiving gathering know what they're missing out on. This reminds me of the question from the new female comrade last week about women in the movement, and I've seen a lot of small, racially conscious groups try to start up a women's division of some sort, and it eventually fails because there just aren't enough women to keep it going. Well, I can say that here we do have a lot of women and we are able to have get-togethers like this. I'm glad I can finally live somewhere in the homeland where this is a reality. I like it when people get things done as opposed to just talking about all the great important things they're going to do for the white race one day. I'd like to start out by answering my own moronic emails. These will be short. Dear Axis Sally, how will I know what you look like? I guess you won't. Does my appearance have any effect on your dedication to the cause? Dear Axis Sally, why do you have so much anger toward men? Because you play too many video games. Actually, I tend to be a hateful, angry person in general, which is why I joined a terrorist organization like the Northwest Front, and since this movement is largely made up of men, it's going to be mostly men who come into contact with all my rage. Dear Axis Sally, I just wanted you to know that after you made those comments about the creativity movement, I researched it a little and saw how they all tell lies about Harold, so I have decided not to pursue them anymore. Well, I'm glad I could help. I don't care what sort of creed you want to live by as long as it's in favor of the 14 words. Maybe if we meet, we can have some sort of book burning with my copy of Nature's Eternal Religion. Dear Axis Sally, how can I convert my girlfriend to racism? You can't. I know you'll try anyway, but you can't, and it will end badly, and the best you can hope for is that she'll pretend to go along with it, and then will use it against you years later, either in family court or divorce court. Dear Axis Sally, I noticed this person left a comment on your Facebook page. I don't like this person, so I was wondering why you would be his friend. Well, probably because I just add everyone to the Facebook page, except those who I know for a fact are worthless race traitors, and I don't bother to check with you first. I'm sorry. Dear Axis Sally, I'm going to vote for Ron Paul, and this will save our entire race, and America will be great again, and we'll send all the niggers back, and property values will soar, and my begonias will finally bloom. Okay, he didn't say those exact words. Do the six of you know each other? Anyway, Harold and I were talking yet again about the character issue in our movement. It comes up a lot. He frequently says, I've spent the past 40 years trying to figure out why we are like this, and I think there are several reasons why. Let's take a typical movement loser who does typical losery things. Someone who has been a rat, a race traitor, perhaps someone who has hurt white children or elderly whites, a drug user, maybe one who neglects his own children in favor of garbage like going to white power concerts and playing with his stupid boots. The people I'm thinking of are those who continually violate one of those rules that Harold keeps telling us not to break, which basically says we're not supposed to collaborate with Zog in order to harm another white nationalist. Things like using the police, the FBI, and Child Protective Services to get back at comrades. There will be plenty of people who talk trash about these individuals, but we all know you can't ever be kicked out of the movement. Maybe you can be kicked out of an organization, but there are so many organizations to choose from, or you can always make up your own and make up all the rules. No matter what horrible things you do to other people or to our race, you will find a place in this movement. We all know that when we want to stop undesirable behavior, we must enforce a consequence. Say we have a cat who continues to jump on top of the table and get into the butter dish. The way we deal with movement losers and traitors is the equivalent of telling the cat, stop it, bad kitty, no, bad, over and over again. Why is any effort made to protect those who hurt our race or who hurt their own comrades? Most of the excuses I've heard all come back to one thing. We don't want to offend the poor sack of crap. Maybe they send us money. Maybe they have a lot of friends who send us money. Maybe, just maybe, if we tell someone about how this race traitor collaborated with Zog in a way that violated the 14 words, one of their dumb friends might get all butthurt and stop sending their $20 checks. The other excuse I hear is that we have to have absolute proof that a certain comrade is vile trash before making this fact known. No, we don't. How often are we in a position to get this kind of proof anyway? I don't need to see YouTube clips or hear some audio recording to know that certain people are scum to avoid. And, much like the emasculated white man who calls the cops because his wife yelled at him or he heard a noise in the yard, the butthurt white nationalist calls Harold to tell on another comrade. Most of the problems are petty, like who has Jewish facial features or who listens to the wrong music, and a few problems merit serious attention, such as who is an informant and who is a probable pedophile. It's been made clear that, as a movement, we will not do anything about these people. We won't kick them out of a non-existent organization, we won't ban them from any movement functions, we won't even warn newcomers about them. Well, some of us won't. Some of us will focus more on that $20 check and how we can't possibly offend anyone, which is pretty much the worst thing in the entire world. If we offend someone, they might not want to join our little racist club, and then the revolution will never happen because apparently the future of our race was dependent upon those who wallow in self-pity and cry about how someone was mean. But some of us have had enough of protecting vermin. I would like to see us as a movement dare to speak the name of the elephant in the room, or whatever you prefer to call her, or him. I would also like to see us settle our own problems. If someone hits you, do you tell Harold? What about if someone breaks into your home? And what about if there is a bitch of a traitor or a disgusting pervert in our midst? Someone who takes pleasure in sabotage of comrades and living in filth and decadence. Stop telling on them and start doing something about them. So, the reason we are like this and have been for 40 years is because we put up with it. We'll never do anything more than say, bad kitty, no, no, that's a bad, bad kitty, bad. Because in the end, it's so much easier to let the stupid cat have the butter. Consequences must be swift, painful, and consistent in order to be effective. But that's too hard. I don't want to do it. I think what I will do instead is send out a list of rules of acceptable conduct every 6 months, so those of you who know how to read can read the ones you're breaking, and this will free up more time for my video game playing. No, actually, it will free up more time for me to spend with the awesome group of Aryan women we have here in our little area. I am so grateful for this, and I'm really looking forward to this Thanksgiving. I'll also be laughing at everyone who starves themselves on Thanksgiving because they feel guilty for being white. I love being white, I love food, and I love all of you.
Yeah, as you may have guessed, we've had a couple more incidents of space madness over the past few weeks. Nothing major, actually, just more of the same. I've probably become hardened to it, or maybe numbed is the better word. Sally's still young and idealistic enough to get mad over it. She hasn't reached the point of this dull fatalism that most of us older participants have attained, this quiet acceptance that this is just the way we are, and we'll never change, and the goat-dancing fools will always be with us. I envy that in her, being young enough to still be offended by the goo-boo crap. Me, I lost the capacity for outrage somewhere along the line many years ago. I know I'm going to get emails. Oh, Harold, Harold, what's happening to you? You're becoming so mean and so crude and talking about buggery and nigger butt cheeks, and then you let that wicked woman say all those bad, nasty things, and you're not entertaining anymore, and somebody told me you did something back in the 1990s, and you're a mean, bad man, and I want my mommy. Wah. Okay, let's run this down again. Contrary to what you hear about me, I hate and despise this crap, so I'll try to make it as quick as I can without violating the first taboo of the movement, which is don't name names. When some white nationalist individual, or perhaps I should say someone who is perceived as a white nationalist, thanks to the media, makes a horse's ass out of themselves, then we are never so unkind as to mention the fact among ourselves. It's kind of like being stuck in an elevator when somebody cuts a fart and everybody pretends not to notice. As we all know, if we simply ignore a problem or an embarrassment, it eventually just goes away, right? I'm not ready to throw the first taboo overboard just quite yet, largely because most of our listeners simply don't get it. They don't understand the necessity to face up to ourselves in a mirror, squarely. Not yet, anyway. If they get involved and stay involved for any length of time, they will. At some point in time, white nationalism is going to have to do the old Alcoholics Anonymous trick and carry out a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. But like alcoholism, that's no good, nothing can be done if you don't admit that you have a problem. And the fact is that most of us who are new to the movement don't yet fully understand that we have a problem. And many of the older hands have spent years and sometimes decades ignoring the fact that we have a problem. And sorry, I know I promised I'd be quick, and instead I'm starting to wander off on a tangent again. Like Sally said, I've been putting up with this childish horseshit behavior on the part of people who claim to believe as we do for 40 years now. And she's right. I send out the Red Lines leaflet with its code of white nationalist ethics in every intro pack. I send out the Red Lines by email, and I post the Red Lines on the blogs every so often, and that's about it. To give you guys credit, most of you do comply with the ethical rules that I lay down there, but if you don't, there's nothing that I or anyone else can do about it. A large part of the failure of the movement over the past 50 years is due to our complete unwillingness and inability to impose any sanctions for misbehavior on those who claim to represent us in public and whose misbehavior brings the 14 words into disrepute and causes our own people to regard us with hatred, ridicule, and contempt. This is how we get so-called leaders who embezzle hundreds of thousands of dollars, which they then proceed to gamble away in casinos. They get caught, plead guilty, go to prison, and then hit the ground running when they come out as if nothing had ever happened. This is how we get men who have testified against their own former comrades in not one, but two, count them, two capital cases, as in possible death penalty. They spend years in the witness protection program and then decide that they want to come waltzing back into the movement and relive their glory days in the full expectation that everything is forgotten or at least forgiven. And you know something? Sometimes they're right. This is how we get child molesters and registered sex offenders trying to sneak back into the movement, at least on the internet end, and doing so with some success. Because we have such short memories, and no one is willing to sit down and inform new people as to who to avoid, like I used to be dumb enough to try. And, well, I'm doing it again, aren't I?
Oh, I gave you a plate of corn muffins back in 1947 to paint my chicken coop, and you never did it!
Anyone who wants to do so is free to associate themselves with us, especially on the internet nowadays, and they're perfectly free to go running around laughing and cackling and screaming obscenities and soiling themselves and falling to the floor, foaming at the mouth, so to speak, and no one can do anything about it. Nor is there any way to dissociate the real racial cause from the freak show in people's minds. I learned the hard way on Usenet many years ago that these people cannot be simply shouted down because there's no gatekeeper, and it just goes on and on and on. There's no way to compel these creatures to stay the hell away from us. Sally is right. What we need is a kind of internal disciplinary hit squad like Tony Soprano and his boys, moving around the country and dragging certain people out of their crummy little furnished apartments and their mobile homes where they crouch over their computers in the dark, whacking these people upside the head and breaking a few bones with baseball bats. And then Tony tells them, okay, from now on, you are going to stay the fuck away from the white nationalist movement. Whatever demons in your head you're wrestling with, you will not use white nationalism as your arena. You want to become a TV preacher, you want to become a circus clown, you want to form an Atlantis cult, you want to peddle gold and silver to old people to try and get at their savings, you want to do infomercials for salad shooters, whatever you want to do to let the gibberish in your head run loose in the world, fine. But you will not do it in any way, shape, or form related to white nationalism or the 14 words. Oh, God, if only. I have a list of about 10 people, albatrosses around the movement's neck, that if we could just somehow remove them from any association in the public's mind with our cause, get them the hell away from us, then the improvement that we would see in our material, the improvement in our reception by the public, the improvement in our morale and in our overall results would really be profound. If we could just somehow physically boot out these 10, maybe a dozen individuals and make it clearly understood that they are aberrations or possibly agents, but whatever they are not us, then we could start really bringing in people from the white community itself. Normal, intelligent, and mature adults do not want to be associated with a freak show. They do not want to be associated with the kind of mental and emotional dysfunction that this movement seems to attract way too much of, and which we seem completely unable to purge from ourselves. Okay, in the first version of this section of the podcast, at this point I went off onto a long 3 or 4 page rant, which I eventually realized was turning into nothing more than my usual tirade on the character issue. So let's just deep six that and let me start over here and see if I can't find something new to say on a topic which has almost been beaten to death on here, but which, at the same time, is probably the most important issue that we have to deal with. The issue of our own ability to fulfill the 14 words and beyond that of our moral fitness to do so. I have said this before, and I'll say it again. Whether or not we win this struggle for racial survival, Northwestwise or anywhere on this continent, and in any way, is going to depend on whether or not we can successfully deal with the issue of character. First off, improving our own character. And secondly, by successfully expelling or severing certain individuals who are clearly too badly damaged to participate. Sally nailed that one. You guys want to know why I let her on here saying such things? It's because she's telling the truth, kind of in the way I used to. At some point in the future, we are going to have to go to the white community of North America, and we are going to have to say to them, we are fit and ready to lead you out of this hell and into a better world. And it has to be true, because white people will follow genuine, committed, mature, and adult men and women who seek to make this world better, to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. They will not follow a bunch of mentally and emotionally disturbed and dysfunctional middle-aged adolescents for whom life is a series of psychological head games played on the internet and off. We must have the ability to lead, and we must have the moral right to lead. Right now we have neither. Because we refuse to face up to the issue of our own character, which is frightened and weak, and that of a small minority of deeply disturbed people who are in this movement to try and get something out of it, not put something into it. Now, I honestly don't know what we're going to do about this. Practically speaking, in the real world, we will never have Tony Soprano and the boys to track down these assholes and go upside their heads with baseball bats to make them get away from us and stay away from us. We don't have the stones for it, any more than we have the stones for revolting against Zog. But there has to be a spiritual awakening and rebirth of some kind among white people. And as part of that, the crazy and the vicious among us have to be silenced and removed somehow, and the adults have to take over. Okay, enough. We need something musical to wash away the bad taste of that last wretched topic. I'm going to play this next song for no other reason than the fact that this is my program and I like it. This is Willie Nelson and Sheryl Crow.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
If you were a carpenter and I were a lady, I'd marry you anyway. I'd have your baby.
If a tinker was my trade, would I still find you?
I'd be carrying the pots you made, following behind you.
Save my love for loneliness, save my love for sorrow. I've given you my onlyness, give me your tomorrow. If I were a miller with a mill wheel grinding, would you miss your colored blouse and your soft shoes shining?
If you were a miller and a mill wheel grinding, I'd miss my colored blouse and my soft shoes shining.
Say my love for loneliness, say my love for sorrow. I've given you my loneliness, give me your tomorrow. If I work my hands in wood, would you still love me?
I'd answer you, yes, I would.
Would you not be above me? And if I were a carpenter and you were a lady,
I'd marry you anyway. I'd have your baby.
Say my love for loneliness, say my love for sorrow. Giving you my onlyness, give me your tomorrow. Giving you my onlyness, give me your
tell you what, in view of today's holiday, rather than wind this up with a final rant, as is my usual custom, I will once more delve into the archives of the Weird Aryan History series and read to you folks the first Thanksgiving proclamation, the date of which is June the 20th, 1676. It was issued by the governor and the Council of State of what was then the Royal British Colony of Massachusetts. The holy God, having by a long and continual series of his afflictive dispensations in and by the present war with the heathen natives of this land, written and brought to pass bitter things against his own covenant people in this wilderness, yet so that we evidently discern that in the midst of his judgments he hath remembered mercy, having remembered his footstool in the day of his sore displeasure against us for our sins, with many singular intimations of his fatherly compassion and regard, reserving many of our towns from desolation threatened and attempted by the enemy, and giving us especially of late with many of our Confederates, many signal advantages against them, without such disadvantage to ourselves as formerly we have been sensible of. If it be the Lord's mercy that we are not consumed, it certainly bespeaks our positive thankfulness when our enemies are in any measure disappointed or destroyed. And fearing the Lord should take notice under so many intimations of his returning mercy, we should be found an insensible people as not standing before him with thanksgiving, as well as lading him with our complaints in the time of pressing afflictions. The council has thought meet to appoint and set apart the 29th day of this instant June as a day of solemn thanksgiving and praise to God for such his goodness and favor, many particulars of which mercy might be instanced, but we doubt not those who are sensible of God's afflictions have been as diligent to espy him returning to us, and that the Lord may behold us as a people offering praise and thereby glorifying him. The council doth commend it to the respective ministers, elders, and people of this jurisdiction, solemnly and seriously to keep the same, beseeching that, being persuaded by the mercies of God, we may all, even this whole people, offer up our bodies and souls as a living and acceptable service unto God by Jesus Christ. Note that the actual first Thanksgiving was proclaimed 56 years after the landing at Plymouth Rock, and so it had nothing to do with the Pilgrims. Note also that it was in June, which actually makes a lot more sense than a cold Massachusetts November. Finally, note that the first Thanksgiving was to celebrate a white military victory over the Indians, not to invite them all to sit around the same table over turkey and cranberry sauce. The present November holiday originated as a propaganda stunt proclaimed by Abraham Lincoln in 1863 during the Civil War in order to distract the North's attention from the fact that at the time the Union was getting its ass kicked by the Confederate Army. So when you're chowing down on your turkey and cranberry sauce and pumpkin pie today, remember those rebel yells I played on the program a few weeks ago. They're the reason you're having your feast today, not some nonsense about pilgrims getting all palsy-walsy with people whom they correctly viewed as ignorant and dangerous savages. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha on the bond. Freedom.